Usually when you think about an epic Odyssean journey, you picture Greek heroes, right?
Absolutely. Like
Yeah.
10 years at sea battling literal monsters.
Right. But you don't usually picture a 19-year-old college student getting ejected from two consecutive commuter trains just because he tried to travel with a bicycle during rush hour.
Yeah, it definitely lacks a certain mythological romance, doesn't it?
It really does.
But honestly, I mean, anyone who has ever tried to navigate public transit with a bike knows that struggle is profoundly real.
Oh, it's a modern trial by fire. And that exact image, this grueling 2-day travel nightmare of delays and detours, is how Adam opens this week's issue of What Adam Is Reading.
Which is such a fantastic newsletter.
It is. Now, for those of you just joining us, you deserve a quick roadmap for what you are about to hear. What you're listening to right now is an AI-generated conversational deep dive into that exact newsletter. Specifically, we're looking at the issue from the week of August 10th, 2026.
Yeah, and just for some context, this is a project Adam has been running since March 2020. He basically compiles a weekly review of articles and ephemera for colleagues and friends who are exploring data in healthcare.
Exactly. Adam is the author of the newsletter and the commentary, and he handpicked all the articles we're talking about today. He also uses Claude to help improve the writing clarity and for fact-checking. And you can dive into all the past issues yourself at whatadamisreading.com.
It's an incredibly rich resource, honestly. I mean, the curation alone forces you to connect dots across fields you wouldn't normally, put together.
And this week is a perfect example of that. Adam contrasts his son's physical endurance on that train journey with his own intellectual exhaustion.
Right, because he had just been at a conference.
Yeah, he had just attended an unconference in Boston, one of those heavily interactive events driven by like small group discussions instead of formal lectures. And he shares this anecdote about someone there casually announcing they had just changed their favorite color. Yeah, think about that. A grown adult just admitting they are still a work in progress. It's a very vulnerable, quiet thing to uncover about yourself.
That contrast actually beautifully sets up the thematic through line for all the sources we're looking at today.
How so?
Well, because whether it's an adult realizing their identity is still fluid, or a son discovering a hidden reserve of heroic resilience, or scientists uncovering buried data, this entire collection of articles is really about revealing what is hidden beneath the surface.
Ah, I love that.
Yeah, today we're going to be lifting the layers on long dormant viruses, some deeply flawed medical data, and ultimately the privacy of our own internal thoughts.
Okay, let's unpack this, and let's start with the ultimate physical stress test, because we go from the stress of a travel nightmare to, well, the biological trauma of a severe COVID infection.
Right, so a new paper published in Nature offers a really remarkable look at this. The researchers tracked a very specific cohort of 1,154 vaccine-naive patients.
And they were hospitalized for COVID across 20 U.S. hospitals, right?
Exactly. And because this was between May 2020 and March 2021, these patients had absolutely no prior immunity.
Wow.
And they didn't just check on them once, either. They tracked them for up to a year, taking nasal swabs, blood samples, and for the ventilated patients, they even took endotracheal aspirates from deep in their lungs.
But the twist here is they weren't just tracking the COVID virus. They went hunting for other things hiding in the body.
Yeah, and they found them.
They really did. About half of these patients had chronic viruses actively transcribing, meaning they were actively copying themselves and waking up all within the first 40 days of their COVID diagnosis.
What's fascinating here is the precise schedule these viruses kept. It wasn't just random biological noise.
Right.
Epstein-Barr virus, or EBV, which is incredibly common, that peaked right at hospital admission and then slowly faded. But then, around week three, you start seeing the emergence of cytomegalovirus, CMV, and HSV-1.
And for anyone wondering, HSV-1 is herpes simplex virus 1, which is the virus responsible for cold sores. It's basically a master at hiding in our nerve cells.
Yes, exactly.
It's like these chronic viruses are sleeper agents. They've been living quietly in the body for years, maybe decades. And the moment the immune system security guards are completely distracted by this massive main stage COVID invasion, the sleeper agents just wake up to wreak havoc.
That is the exact dynamic at play. But the real revelation in this data, the thing that kind of flips our understanding on its head, is the underlying mechanism of why they woke up.
Okay, wait, what do you mean?
Well, for a long time, the medical assumption was that viral reactivation requires a chemically suppressed immune system. You know, the kind of state you see in organ transplant patients who have to take heavy medication to stop their bodies from rejecting a new kidney.
Oh, I see. So the assumption was that the drugs the doctors gave the COVID patients were causing the reactivation.
Precisely. But this study showed that immunosuppressive medication did not fully explain the reactivation. Severe COVID itself, totally independent of those drugs, triggers it.
That is terrifying.
It is. The sheer scale of systemic inflammation and immune exhaustion caused by the primary COVID infection essentially depletes the T cells. The guards are simply too tired from fighting the main fire to keep the prison doors locked.
And there was one more virus they found hiding out, right? Annulloviridae.
Yes. So it's a family of viruses that lives in 80 to 90% of the human population. It's so ubiquitous and usually so harmless that we rarely even test for it outside of highly specific transplant scenarios.
Well, they found it here.
They did. The researchers found Annulloviridae popping up months after the initial COVID infection. And crucially, it was most common in patients reporting persistent long-term physical disabilities.
Now, obviously, association isn't causation. We have to be clear about that. They aren't explicitly stating this obscure virus causes long COVID.
Right. No, they aren't.
But it's a massive red flag. If nothing else, seeing how a primary infection triggers this cascade of hidden biological chaos, I mean, it's an incredibly strong argument for staying current on COVID vaccines. The whole goal is to keep your immune system from ever having to fight that massive, exhausting fire in the first place.
Exactly. Keep the guards well rested and the sleeper agents stay asleep.
Well said. So in human biology, viruses hide behind a primary infection. But in the world of healthcare data, the truth often hides behind flashy hyperbolic press releases.
Oh, definitely.
And this brings us to an incredibly frustrating example from the American College of Cardiology.
It is a classic case of bad data translation. So the ACC put out a press release citing research from UC Riverside. They looked at nearly 250,000 patients with known heart disease.
That's a huge sample size.
It is. But the claim was staggering. They said patients who received the shingles vaccine had 46% fewer major cardiac events over the following year.
Which sounds amazing.
It does sound amazing. But then they claimed those same vaccinated patients were 66% less likely to die from any cause.
Wait, 66% fewer deaths from anything? Like a car crash? A falling piano?
Literally any cause.
I'm going to guess the shingles vaccine does not generate a magical force field around the human body. So are we just looking at a scenario where people who voluntarily seek out adult vaccines happen to be wealthier, have better access to healthcare, and maybe just generally take better care of themselves?
You've hit the nail on the head. In statistical terms, that is known as the healthy user effect.
Right.
When an intervention magically appears to prevent death from every completely unrelated cause, the data isn't describing the pharmacological power of the drug. It is describing the personality and socioeconomic status of the patient.
That makes so much sense. People who get the shingles vaccine are statistically the same people who eat their vegetables, go to the gym, and, you know, have great health insurance.
Exactly. And to make it worse, this massive, sweeping claim was based on a non-peer-reviewed conference poster.
Oh, that's just irresponsible. If data looks too good to be true, like a vaccine preventing death from literally anything, how can we, as curious learners, spot the healthy user effect before we fall for a press release?
Well, Adam contrasts this with a study out of Wales that actually did the math right. And in the process, they found a genuine hidden truth about the shingles vaccine and dementia.
Oh, I loved this part of the newsletter.
Right. The Welsh study is an absolute masterclass in study design because they found a way to bypass the healthy user effect entirely. They rolled out the older Zostavax shingles vaccine using a strict, unbendable date of birth cutoff.
Okay.
If you were under 80 years old on a highly specific date, you were eligible. If you were 80 or older on that exact same day, you are not.
Which is a brilliant natural experiment because an 80-year-old and a 79-year-old and 364-day-old person are basically biologically identical.
Exactly.
Their dietary habits, their wealth, their exercise routines, all those variables are going to be evenly distributed across that one-day age divide.
Precisely. The strict cutoff creates an inherent randomized control group that washes out all those human behavioral biases. Over the next 7 years, they tracked both groups. And the vaccinated group had about a 20% relative drop in new dementia diagnoses.
Now, because Adam writes for a data-savvy crowd, we really need to clarify that 20% relative drop.
Good point.
Because in absolute terms, that's a drop of 3.5 percentage points. It basically means if roughly 17 out of 100 people were going to get dementia, the vaccine knocked that down to about 13 or 14 people.
That's a crucial distinction. Absolute risk reduction is a much clearer way to look at population-level benefits. But you know the most important part of this study?
What's that?
When the researchers checked the healthy user effect, meaning did the vaccinated group also have miraculously fewer deaths from other unrelated causes or more preventative care visits, they found absolutely nothing.
Wow, just less dementia.
Yes. And there is a strong biological theory for why this happens. The neuroinflammation theory suggests that when viruses like herpes zoster reactivate and travel along our nerves, they can reach the brain, triggering severe inflammation.
Which accelerates the buildup of amyloid plaques associated with dementia, right?
Exactly. By stopping the virus from waking up, you stop the downstream brain damage.
That's incredible. But a major caveat for anyone listening in the U.S. is that the Zostavax vaccine used in that study isn't sold here anymore.
Right.
We get Shingrix, which is generally a far superior, more effective vaccine for shingles. But ironically, the evidence linking Shingrix specifically to dementia prevention is currently only observational, which basically dumps us right back into the murky, biased waters of the healthy user effect. We just don't have that perfect Welsh date of birth cutoff data for Shingrix yet.
It really highlights how vigilant you have to be. A press release can shout about a miracle cure, while the actual hidden truth requires rigorous, boring, methodical study designed to uncover.
Yeah. And, you know, a press release overselling data is frustrating. But our next topic explores the devastating consequences when scientists actively, intentionally hide fatal data from the public. And I'll warn you, this is a very tough story to hear.
It really is. It is a tragedy born from an intellectual fractal, as Adam puts it, meaning you find layer upon layer of the exact same ethical failure all the way down.
It's awful.
It started in 2023 when parents of a four-year-old girl discovered she had a mutation in a gene called CHD3.
And to give some context, the CHD3 gene is essentially an instructor that tells DNA how tightly it should be packaged in our cells, which directly impacts early brain development.
Yeah.
A mutation causes developmental delays, sometimes severe ones. But crucially, it is not a fatal condition. People with this mutation live normal lifespans.
Right. But despite that, the parents were deeply terrified she wouldn't be able to live independently. Desperate for a solution, the father reached out to a gene editing researcher in Shanghai, offering to fund a cure that didn't even exist yet.
And the researcher replied almost immediately, didn't he?
In just 13 minutes. Over the next 2 years, the family paid roughly $860,000 to this team. And that included wiring $130,000 directly to a researcher's personal bank account.
The moment personal bank accounts get involved in clinical research, every alarm bell in the world should be ringing.
Absolutely.
But the ethical breaches only accelerate from there. The hospital's ethics committee actually approved a first-in-human brain infusion trial 6 weeks before the animal safety data even existed.
And when that animal data did finally arrive, it was disastrous. They tested the gene therapy on 4 monkeys. All 4 suffered moderate to severe liver injury, and 1 experienced significant kidney damage.
And we should clarify, the danger wasn't necessarily the DNA edit itself, but the viral vector, you know, the microscopic delivery trucks they used to carry the edit into the cells. They were using untested, highly concentrated combinations. And yet, knowing the monkeys suffered liver and kidney damage, they moved forward. In March 2025, the girl, who was now 6 years old, received an infusion of trillions of these viral particles directly into the fluid around her brain.
The outcome was rapid and horrific. She developed a condition called thrombotic microangiopathy. Her immune system aggressively attacked the lining of her own small blood vessels, leading to catastrophic kidney failure. She died 7 days after the infusion.
The fact that this happened is horrifying, but the fact that the researchers then covered it up is unconscionable.
Unbelievable.
Less than a year later, they published their animal data in the prestigious journal Nature. They completely hid the human trial. They hid the fact that the grieving family funded it. They hid the liver and kidney damage in the monkeys. And they hid the death of a 6-year-old child.
This raises an important question about systemic institutional failure. Because the bureaucracies knew, the hospital knew, the District Health Commission knew, the university knew.
And did they do anything?
The only consequence handed down was a roughly $3,600 fine and some verbal counseling.
That makes my blood boil.
The only reason the scientific community knows the truth today is because the parents had the foresight to record their meetings and gave the tapes to investigative reporters at Science and Retraction Watch.
Which brings up a really heavy philosophical debate. Should journals retract studies with such deep, systemic, ethical violations? Because I look at this and think, well, the underlying DNA edit did actually work in mice. If you retract the paper, you are burying that foundational science, potentially forcing another lab down the line to waste time or repeat a mistake. Isn't the data itself still valuable, despite the monsters who collected it?
It's a very common argument in science, but it ignores the moral hazard. Yes, the foundational science wasn't junk, but if you allow the paper to stand, you reward the researchers with a citation and career advancement.
That's a good point.
More importantly, the translation of that science was fatally flawed, precisely because they abandoned stepwise, gated research. The monkey efficacy study used a completely different viral vector and a different dosing method than the monkey toxicology study.
Wait, really?
Yes. And that little girl was the very first time those two untested halves were slammed together. The whole point of gated research isn't to create red tape. It's to force every unproven step out into the light. When you hide the gaps between the data, you kill people.
It's a sobering reality. It really is. And it forces us to pivot from the ethics of manipulating human biology to the ethics of unlocking our most private, deeply hidden domain, our internal thoughts.
Yes, we're venturing into the world of brain-to-text AI.
Adam noted that Naomi Boschkansky, a highly respected former alignment researcher at OpenAI, recently left to join a startup called Conduit.
Right, and their explicit mission is to build consumer-grade thought-to-text technology.
Exactly.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because this is no longer the realm of science fiction. Meta has an active project called Brain2QWERTY.
Oh, it uses a giant magnetoencephalograph, which, if you've seen pictures, basically looks like a massive 1970s salon hairdryer in a magnetically shielded room. It reads the brain's motor activity with about 61% accuracy while a user types memorized sentences.
But the real leap, the thing that changes the paradigm, is detailed in a 2025 article from the journal Cell. Researchers used implanted electrodes to decode imagined speech in patients who couldn't move their mouths.
That's wild.
The AI essentially translates the electrical intentions in the motor cortex into text. And the decoder was so incredibly sensitive, it started picking up completely unprompted thoughts. It intercepted participants silently counting shapes on a screen to themselves.
They literally intercepted a human being's inner monologue.
Yes.
But to their credit, the researchers saw the privacy nightmare this could become, so they actually programmed the AI decoder to stay dark, to completely stop listening, until the patient thought of a highly specific mental password.
And you'll never guess the password.
Oh, I know it. The password they chose was chitty chitty bang bang, and the software recognized that specific thought with 98.75% accuracy.
The engineering is undeniably incredible, but when we zoom out, it connects to a much larger anxiety regarding corporate privacy. The academic researchers in that Cell paper ethically declined to publish the unprompted thoughts they intercepted. But will a Silicon Valley tech startup fighting for market share exercise that same restraint?
Probably not.
Who actually owns the data of your unprompted private thoughts?
It's wild to think about. It's like we are rapidly approaching a future where you have to install a two-factor authentication app directly into your cerebral cortex just to build a mental Faraday cage against big tech algorithms.
The science is peer-reviewed, the investment is massive, and it's moving way faster than our privacy laws can possibly adapt.
Definitely. So from the incredibly complex electrical wiring of the brain, let's shift to the unsung, largely hidden plumbing of the body. Adam writes about visiting his friends in Denver at over 5,000 feet of altitude and how our internal biological systems quietly adapt to invisible environmental changes.
It's a great case study in physiology.
Yeah.
Most people assume altitude sickness happens simply because there's less oxygen in the mountain air.
Right, that's what everyone says.
But the atmosphere is actually about 21% oxygen everywhere on Earth, whether you're at sea level or on top of Everest. What actually changes is the barometric pressure. At 5,000 feet, there is less physical weight of the atmosphere pressing down to force that oxygen into your bloodstream. So partial pressure drops, making it feel like you are only breathing 17% oxygen.
And your body's immediate panicky fix for this is to just breathe faster. You hyperventilate to grab more air. But there's a hidden dangerous cost to that. When you hyperventilate, you blow off way too much carbon dioxide.
Exactly.
And carbon dioxide isn't just waste. It's a key ingredient your body uses to keep your blood's acidity perfectly balanced.
If you lose too much CO2, your blood pH begins to rise. You develop a state called alkalosis. And this is where your kidneys have to quietly step in to save your life.
Because if they did...
If the kidneys didn't intervene, that rising blood alkalosis would trigger an emergency override, forcing your lungs to stop hyperventilating.
Mm-hmm.
And at that altitude, if you stop breathing heavily, you pass out from hypoxia.
I love this analogy. It's like the lungs are the dramatic late actor who keeps messing up their lines, right?
Yes.
And the kidneys are the quiet, hardworking stage crew frantically cleaning up the mess backstage so the show doesn't get canceled. The kidneys start aggressively dumping bicarbonate, which is a powerful acid-base buffer, directly into your urine to artificially rebalance the acidity of your blood.
Which perfectly explains the physical misery of altitude sickness. By dumping all that bicarbonate, the kidneys pull water with it. That's why your first 24 hours at high altitude usually involve severe volume loss, dehydration, and just endless trips to the bathroom.
Right.
Acclimatizing to altitude is never just about breathing. It is fundamentally a two-organ affair. And then once the emergency is handled, the kidneys start their second project.
Which is ramping up a hormone called erythropoietin, or EPO, right?
Yep, which signals your bone marrow to build more oxygen-carrying red blood cells for a permanent long-term fix.
The humble kidney, the unsung hero of the Rockies. Now, for our final section, we are going to take a slightly more lighthearted path, because sometimes the things we uncover aren't actually hidden, they aren't even real. Sometimes our primate brains just project patterns onto the world that don't exist.
Oh, this is fun. We are talking about the fascinating biological interplay between Kinjin schema, which is the evolutionary trigger that makes us find baby-like features uncontrollably cute, and pareidolia, which is our brain's desperate tendency to see human faces in random patterns where no face exists.
And Adam brings up a few deeply weird sea creatures to illustrate this. First, you have the sea pig, which is essentially just a deep sea cucumber. It's plump, translucent, and trundles around the ocean floor on these weird little inflatable tube legs.
It heavily triggers our Kinjin schema because it's basically shaped like a helpless baby with no face.
It is oddly adorable. And on the opposite end of the spectrum, you have the skeleton panda sea squirt. It is a tiny, newly described tunicate found off the coast of Japan.
Which looks exactly like a translucent blob wearing a tiny, terrifyingly accurate panda mask.
Yes, but the panda face is pure pareidolia. It's just random white and black pigment spots that our brains insist on turning into an animal. But the evolutionary irony here is what's truly incredible.
Oh, I love this part.
The sea pig, which looks like an adorable little piglet, is an echinoderm. It is completely alien to us on the evolutionary tree. But the panda sea squirt, which looks like a cartoon mistake, is a tunicate. Its larva actually has a primitive dorsal nerve cord. It is literally the closest invertebrate relative to vertebrates, meaning it is closer to us.
It's a hilarious reminder of how desperate our neurological wiring is to find familiar narratives in the wild. We humanize absolutely everything we look at.
We really do. And it doesn't stop at sea squirts. We even humanize the absurd, like the red-lipped batfish, which just looks like a grumpy old man wearing far too much terrible lipstick while shuffling across the ocean floor.
We project our own nonsense onto biology constantly. Adam even links to a story about marmot researchers who, facing severe federal budget cuts, actually started an OnlyFans page for their marmots to try and raise research funds.
It sounds like a joke, but it highlights a very grim reality about how science is funded, or rather underfunded, today.
It does.
It's actually a perfect bizarre contrast to the heartbreaking Shanghai gene editing story. In both cases, you have dedicated researchers facing a total vacuum of traditional institutional funding, which forces them to resort to extreme, unorthodox measures. One ends in an ethical nightmare and a lost life, and the other ends with field biologists trying to monetize cute rodents on the internet.
Two wildly different responses to the exact same systemic vacuum. It's a stark reminder of the immense pressures scientists operate under. Though, obviously, I prefer the researchers choosing the marmot calendar over the unapproved human trials.
Same. And throw in the fact that Adam also found a Scientific American article about daddy long legs mating habits that was so grammatically unhinged, debating the correct pluralization of daddy long legs while simultaneously using the word fellatio in the title, that the editors actually had to change the headline after publishing.
It is a wildly weird world out there.
It really is. And to tie all of these seemingly disparate threads together, we should look at the AI art prompt Adam generated for this week's newsletter. It perfectly encapsulates everything we've just discussed.
It really does. He prompted the AI to create a 16th century anatomical fugitive sheet. For those who don't know, these were old medical broadsides with literal layered paper flaps that medical students could lift up to study the hidden organs underneath.
Right. And the resulting image is dripping with symbolism. There is a flap revealing oversized, hyper-detailed kidneys, a clear nod to our high-altitude stage crew.
There's a hinged flap over the cranium secured with a heavy brass padlock, representing the lockdown privacy of thought-to-text AI.
But the most striking detail in the image is a flap over the lower torso. Unlike the others, it is sewn shut with heavy red thread and completely sealed with red wax. It cannot be lifted. Nothing is visible beneath it.
It is the ultimate metaphor for this entire deep dive. The whole purpose of a fugitive sheet, and really of science itself, is to lift the layers and see what's hidden. Today, we've lifted the flaps on long COVID sleeper viruses, on data manipulation masquerading as miracles, on tragic ethical breaches hidden from the public, and on AI literally reading our minds.
As a species, we are utterly obsessed with decoding every secret.
We really are.
Which brings us right back to where we started. The vulnerability of the guy at the unconference admitting he was a work in progress, and the incredible tension of revealing what is hidden. So I want to leave you, the listener, with a question to mull over.
What's that?
In a world where technology is constantly lifting every flap, analyzing every data point, and decoding every secret, right down to your unprompted mental password of chitty chitty bang bang, what is the one layer of yourself you would choose to sew shut with red thread and seal with wax? What remains of you when the deep dive is finally over? Think about that. And if you want to explore the sources we unpack today, be sure to check out whatadamisreading.com. Thanks for joining us.